Good morning to everyone here in the Capitol. This hearing of the House Tribal Affairs Committee will now come to order. The time is 8:05 a.m., Thursday, February 19th, 2026, in Capitol Room 106. Members present for House Tribal Affairs are Representative Schwanke, Representative Freer, Representative Story, Representative Carrick, and myself, Chair Dybert. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. And a quick reminder to all of us to silence our cell phones. And let the record reflect that we've been joined by Representative Underwood at 8:05. Good morning. I would like to thank Jordan Nicholson, the Tribal Affairs Secretary from Records, and Doug Bridges from the Juneau LIO for staffing the committee today. Thank you so much. We have one item on the agenda today. We'll be hearing a presentation from the Alaska Federation of Natives on the Dual Management Regulatory Framework of Subsistence in the state. We are joined today in the committee room today by AFN President Ben Mallott, Board Co-Chair Joe Nelson, and Staff Attorney Jeff Toy. Before we begin, I would just like to remind members the purpose of today's hearing. The Alaska Federation of Natives has worked diligently to present us information on the dual management system and how it benefits not only Alaska Native communities, but all Alaskans. AFN represents a large number of tribes across this state. And I would like to recognize that we have tribal members both in this committee and presenting to us today. As the House Tribal Affairs Committee, it is essential that we approach this discussion with respect. While every member may hold different views on the management system, I think we can all agree it's not a perfect system. So I encourage all members to keep an open mind and engage thoughtfully as we consider the topic before us. And with that, I would like to welcome our guests to Tribal Affairs. If you can join us at the table, put yourself on the record, state your affiliation, and proceed with your presentation, and I believe we will go through the slides and hold questions to the end, or you can tell me what works best. Good morning.
Morning.
Good morning, Chair Dybert. Excuse me. Get my coffee moving here. and good on you for starting at 8 a.m. So, Madam Chair Dybert, committee members, thank you for hosting us today. My name is Joe Nelson, co-chair at the Alaska Federation of Natives. This being with the content that we have in the committee, it is, I'll go ahead and offer my Klinkin name is Kahukgu. I'm a brown bear Tekwedi from Yakutat, child of the Kawashka Kwan. Living here in Juneau for quite a few years now. And today is one stop of many for AFN. That's been a long journey, and there's a lot more ahead. There's a lot of content in these slides, a lot of law, but you're all lawmakers. So that's actually what we're going to really get into the weeds here. And for a good part of the delivery will be our staff attorney, Jeff. But my job here is to help open and then wrap up and really just say a warm thank you for doing what you do. We know this committee is a powerful one, a relatively new one, but also the oldest one in the state with the roots that we have in this state. So I'm going to sheesh to all of you for taking up this committee work. Mm-hmm. AFN was formed over 50 plus years ago in the late 60s. A lot of that was about a land claim. That land claim didn't settle everything. There's a lot of things that were left to be settled later that are still a bit unsettled. So we're stuck in a dual management system, which we're all aware of. And our hope is that our children and grandchildren will inherit a better system. So we feel like it is on all of us to improve the system right now. So I'll was going to offer a few more, but I'm going to help later, really, as we talk about solutions. There is a lot of content. We are making a tour around each region to share these, to help educate just everybody on the issues and what needs to happen to improve our system. And it's really all about the one thing that is so important to land. What good is the land if we aren't able to practice as we always have, our way of life? So, Ganesh, for having us this morning.
Anabasi, thank you for opening up with those words. Let the record reflect that we've been joined by Representative Ruffridge at 8:09 a.m. Good morning. Okay, please proceed.
Good morning, Chairman Dibert. My name is Ben Lott. I had the honor of serving as the president of AFN. I am also from Yaktat. I am Sakwedi. I'm also from Rampart. My mother is from Rampart, and she's here in the room with me today, so I want to recognize her. As Jill mentioned, AFN's put a lot of work into this presentation. We recognize that for our membership, our communities in rural Alaska is not only us, it's also all our rural Alaskans. We are often stuck in the middle of a management system that doesn't quite recognize our ways of life. And what we're doing here today is really to set the table and also set the framework of how we could proceed together as one state to a system that could work for both of the work for all of us. I kind of joke that we all know this is a dual management system. You kind of need to be a lawyer or a surveyor to know what land you're on in our state. So we have a lawyer with us, and this presentation has gone from a 9-hour presentation. A team of lawyers kind of condensed it down to what we have now, but it is a very, very complex legal policy framework that we have that really manages our state subsistence framework. And again, you know, for us in rural Alaska, for our communities, we're stuck in the middle. We're often ones that are enforced, criminalized, just for living our ways of life for, you know, both non-natives and natives. So what we're hoping today is, and we plan today, is kind of set the framework of how we could go forward, options that we consider. But it's not only the state, it's also the federal side. You know, our management is a web of both state and federal law. So hopefully, we hope to get through this presentation quickly. Might switch to Jeff Toy real fast to get our attorney up here, kind of go through slides. We're open if you want to have questions as we go or at the end. We could do it either way, I think.
Wonderful. Yeah, so I will just kind of do time checks, okay, and we'll see where we go with the slides.
I'm going to do one more. I'm going to trade my spot for our staff. I'm going to step back here. But just acknowledging the local clans and tribes here with the Auk and Taku, which I know you're very well aware of, but also just from being from Yakutat, I'm a member of Yakutat Tlingit Tribe, a citizen of Tlingit and Haida, a shareholder of Yaktat Kwan, and a shareholder of Sea Alaska. And that's more not about me. That's just acknowledging all of us and all these systems that we inherited from these federal statutes and laws that we're sort of stuck with untangling them a little bit and making them work better for us. So we do have more than our fair share of attorneys. I'm one, but I hand it off to someone else to cover all the content for us here. Mm-hmm. So thank you, Jeff.
Ganesheesh, Joe. Ganesheesh.
Anabasi, Joe.
Anabasi, Dick.
Good morning. Welcome to the table.
Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jeff Toy. I'm a staff attorney with AFN. All right. Thank you for joining us this morning. This slide is a brief overview of how this presentation works. First, I'm going to take us through kind of the story to date, how we got to the system as it exists today. We know that the members of the committee are very familiar with state regulation frameworks, so this has more of an emphasis on the federal laws and how the federal laws interact with the state laws. And then Joe and Ben will talk about some potential options for improving this system and how we can work together. First, a note on terminology. A lot of Alaska Native people don't like the use of the term subsistence. Subsistence has a dictionary and colloquial definition that implies kind of just scraping by, just having enough of what you need to stay alive, but no more. Under the laws as they're used here, the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act, the definition of subsistence is much wider. It includes, or attempts to include, all the different ways that Alaska Native people have practiced subsistence lifestyles over their long history of occupation of Alaska, and it's in that sense that we're using the term today. We also want to talk about the scale of subsistence compared to the scale of other uses of natural resources in Alaska. This graphic is from ADF&G from 2017 and reflects that all subsistence hunting and fishing, expressed as a poundage of resources harvested, accounts for less than 1% of the fishing game taken in the state of Alaska. So while that is an extremely important level of harvest for rural Alaskans and Alaska Native peoples, it really represents a very small quantity of fishing game looked at as a percentage of the overall harvest. We're going to go through the historical background and legal background of subsistence pretty quickly. This will be fairly high level and it'll have to omit some nuance by necessity, but feel free to come back to these slides. We provided these slides as a reference, and we're always happy to answer any questions. So we start with Alaska Natives who have been in Alaska since time immemorial. Up through about 1741, they occupied all the lands of Alaska, and then in 1741, the Russians, quote-unquote, discovered Alaska. And under international law as it existed in Europe at that time, nations who discovered or colonized new parts of the world had, legally speaking, the exclusive right to engage with indigenous people however they saw fit in terms of land ownership. That system prevailed until 1867, when the United States purchased Alaska from Russia. And then in 1884, the Organic Act established the first civil government of the United States within Alaska. That act provided that the Indians or other persons in Alaska would not be disturbed in the possession of any lands actually in their use or occupation until Congress dealt with that question later. Before Congress took further action, there were other laws passed in Alaska that had exemptions for Alaska Native people and for rural residents from otherwise applicable harvest restrictions. For example, federal mining laws extended to Alaska provided that Alaska Native people were not to be disturbed. Regulations on hunting exempted hunting for food or clothing by Native peoples or by rural Alaskans, miners, explorers, and travelers when they were on the journey or in need of food. In 1958, of course, Alaska became the 49th state, and the Statehood Act didn't address Alaska Native land claims or subsistence rights. The Statehood Act did state that the state had to disclaim any right to property of Alaska Native people, including fishing rights, and that that property and those rights remain under the control of the United States. Section 6B, of course, granted the state the right to select a very large amount of land that was vacant, unappropriated, and unreserved at the time of selection. Of course, what land counts as vacant in a place that's already occupied by people is a difficult question to figure out. And that question persisted along the state selection of lands through the formation of AFN, and then, of course, when oil was discovered in Prudhoe Bay and the oil companies wanted to construct the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, that question became really intense because it was necessary to assemble a contiguous block of land running across the state. And that question resulted eventually in the passage of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, or ANCSA, in 1971. ANCSA did a lot of things, and one of the things that it did was extinguish claims based on aboriginal title, which is the legal term for title held by the original inhabitants, the native people of a place, and claims for hunting and fishing rights based on aboriginal title. It did not, unfortunately, include any explicit protection of subsistence rights. We know that was an issue that Congress considered when passing ANCSA. The Congressional Conference Report stated that the Conference Committee expected the Secretary, that's the Secretary of the Interior, and the State of Alaska to take any action necessary to protect the subsistence needs of the natives. But that didn't actually make it into the law itself. And so subsistence continued to be a significant issue. Disputes over subsistence rights and how subsistence rights would be practiced across rural Alaska were certainly one of the foremost things in the mind of Congress when they passed the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act of 1980. The Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act created a lot of national parks in Alaska. It kind of settled the bounds of federal and state lands as they exist now. And it did include a protection for subsistence use on public lands. Congress found in the purposes section of ANILCA that the continuation of the opportunity for subsistence uses by rural residents, both native and non-native, is essential to native physical, economic, traditional, and cultural existence and to non-native physical, economic, traditional, and social existence. Congress considered various options for how to implement subsistence protections in Anilka. And the way that they figured out how to do that is to establish a priority for subsistence use of fish and wildlife on public lands over any other uses, over any other takings of fish and wildlife. Congress considered different versions of this language. Some of the versions included a priority for native people. That consideration wound up not making it into the final law. The final law prioritized use by rural Alaska residents. It's not for native people. It's not a racial or ethnic or tribal preference. It's a rural preference based on residency. And so subsistence uses in Anilka are defined based on customary and traditional uses by rural Alaska residents. The way that subsistence priority is applied essentially states if there's a necessity, if there's not enough of a resource to support all possible uses, then non-subsistence uses get limited first, and then the rural priority is applied considering customary and direct dependence as the mainstay of livelihood, local residency, and the availability of alternative resources to meet subsistence needs or to meet food security needs.
Thank you, Mr. Toy. That was a lot of information to take in. Thank you. You're doing great. We have a question from Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you, Chair Dybert. Through the chair, thank you for being here today. This is obviously an excellent place to sort of ask a lot of questions for those of us who might not live in a rural area or have tribal background. I was lucky enough to spend a little bit of time trying to understand ANCSA. Actually was invited in my first year to a day's worth of education on ANCSA. And we have one slide on ANCSA, and it talks about one little section in there. But ANCSA was a big deal, obviously. I'm preaching to the choir here. And how I understand it is it was the first of its kind in the United States where really there was all parties at the table. There was a discussion being had. Can you kind of speak to how this came about? I mean, I'm imagining there's minutes of the meetings and things like that. I understood ANCSA to be an exchange of sorts where there was a discussion about what's good for us, what's good for the state, what's good for the federal government, and that it was a win of some sorts. Maybe I'm getting that wrong. And kind of speak to that a little bit. The second part is we have the map on the second page about federal lands in Alaska, but it would be interesting to note there was a map actually in that educational session that I attended that showed the lands that were granted under ANCSA, which I think were significant, and I think probably play into some of that. Is that something that you can speak to, just as a general kind of update for me?
Through the chair, thank you for that question. ANCSA is an enormous law, very long law, did a lot of different things, and it did grant significant amounts of land to Native corporations and to Native peoples as privately held land. The way that Native American regulation in the lower 48 works is that lands continue to be held by the federal government in trust for Native people. Alaska tried something different, where it directly granted lands through ANCSA to Native peoples. I have seen other maps that are even harder to read on slides than this map because they carve up in more detail which lands are owned by which parties. For purposes of this presentation, when we're talking about federal lands, lands granted to Native corporations and Native people under ANCSA are privately held. So they're subject to state regulation the same way that lands owned by anyone or any corporation in Alaska would be. So the purpose of this slide is to talk about the federal land management where federal law applies. And so this slide doesn't include the lands granted by ANCSA to individual Alaska Native corporations or Alaska Native peoples. ANCSA certainly was a compromise. It was very focused on land ownership and land rights. Subsistence rights are a little bit different because they depend on mobile resources, fish and game populations that move between state-owned land, federal-owned land, privately-owned land. And so that sort of question of where and when harvest of those resources can occur wasn't settled in ANCSA.
And through the chair, I also want to add that, you know, ANCSA, while it is a incredibly complex and was the first of its time for Alaska Natives, it was not perfect. It has been amended many, many times. In the 1990s, former President AFN Judy Kitka was on the Hill in D.C., changing the ANSCA, because at that time it would have allowed our shares to be sold on the open market. That would have pretty much, give away all of our land. So ANSCA itself has been amended many, many times. It is a living document. At the time it was passed to the secretaries, and the record did say that, the Secretary of Interior, Secretary of Agriculture would uphold or at least protect Alaska Native subsistence rights. And also in ANSCA, too, we were advised to select lands based on our subsistence cultural and need as well. So while there are connections there, it was really just a lands, an economic settlement, but it didn't really fully address our ways of life within the lands. So that's why those lands still help drive it.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Okay. Just a quick
comment. Okay. We have a question from Representative Schwanke.
Thank you, through the chair. Thank you, gentlemen. I was just hoping maybe you could expand a little bit more on the difference between kind of the geographic situation between the ANCs and then the Village Corporation lands, because my understanding is the Village Corporation lands surround a lot of the different individual villages, and it does provide some insulation and protection, at least by the people that live in some of the rural communities. Could you describe that a little bit?
Yeah, so under ANSCA, depending on the size of the community, different villages are able to select different amounts of land. The villages, selected lands around their communities. For example, I serve on the Village Corporation of my mom's home village of Rampart, and Rampart selected lands, meaning Rampart that protected, that where our people have traditionally fished, has had camps, or also have harvested logs. So each village selected lands based on, what they want to do it at that time. Regional corporations own more land than the regions. They have subsurface rights. It is not perfect. We have a lot of inholdings, a lot of patchwork. So again, if you are on federal lands, you might, walked in onto a regional corporation lands, and then that management is now then state management, and you might not know that you walked on lands. Or also, it's different easement to the 14B easements to those inholdings actually do have the federal protection, but not, so it created a very complex patchwork that therefore is a really big burden on our communities to navigate, to know where the lands are. Also for our village corporations, both regional and village, to enforce trespass, because those are private lands. So it's not a perfect system. When we get later on down to our options, we'd kind of talk about that as well, a little bit more in detail. But that's kind of how, when they did the land claims, that's kind of how they divvied it up.
So. Thank you.
Thank you. Please continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When ANILCA and the Federal Subsistence Priority were created, the general system of regulation in the United States is that state governments regulate harvesting of wildlife, fish and wildlife, within their borders. And Congress's intent was that Alaska would continue to administer the harvest of fish and wildlife within the borders of Alaska, subject to this newly created rural subsistence priority. That became a problem after an Alaska Supreme Court decision in 1989 called McDowell. The McDowell decision, the Alaska Supreme Court found that the rural priority for subsistence uses, which Alaska had enacted into its own laws following the passage of the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act, was in violation of the Alaska Constitution. The Alaska Constitution guarantees equal access to all peoples in Alaska, all residents of Alaska, to fish and wildlife. And the Alaska Supreme Court found that privileging one group over another, in this case rural residents over non-rural residents, was unconstitutional under Article 8 of the Alaska Constitution. This created an enormous amount of difficulty in implementing this federal law rural priority, which now couldn't apply under state law. And so the result of the McDowell decision from 1990 to now is that Alaska is not able to implement laws under state law that are identical to or in compliance with federal laws under the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act. Therefore, the Secretaries of the Interior and Agriculture, who are charged with administering the rural preference, created a body called the Federal Subsistence Board and created federal subsistence regulations for hunting and fishing that govern how hunting and fishing can be accomplished in a way that comports with the rural subsistence priority on federal lands and waters in Alaska. And then on state lands and waters in Alaska, the rural subsistence priority does not apply. Alaska law has a subsistence priority, but it applies to all Alaskans. It's not based on rural residency.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I'm going to have a lot of questions.
Yeah,
hopefully
that's
okay.
A lot of information. I'm trying to scroll down notes as well. Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you. Through the chair. So help me understand, ANILCA had a federal rural subsistence priority. Then the state, which maybe I'm wrong on this, but I feel like in Alaska – The land ownership, list of who has what, it's the federal government is number one, then everyone else is a little tiny piece of the pie. Am I wrong in that?
Mr. Toy.
Through the chair, thank you for that question. The federal government does own enormous amounts of land in Alaska. I don't have the specific figures memorized, but there certainly is federal ownership is huge, and then state ownership is huge, and then private ownership, which includes native ownership, is smaller.
Okay. And then a follow-up, Madam Chair. Thank you. So under the McDowell decision, this is saying that on the state land, there is no rural priority because it's unconstitutional, but the ANILCA decision or the ANILCA rule subsistence priority still holds on federal land, but there is a board that governs that. Is that an accurate statement?
Through the chair, yes, that's an accurate statement. So okay. On state lands, which include Alaska Native Corporation and Alaska Native-owned lands, state law applies. On federal lands and waters, the federal regulations under ANILCA preempt the state regulations and apply this rural priority that does not exist under state law. So we'll get to how exactly that shook out through litigation on the next slides. But, yes, you are correct that under state, anywhere the state owns land or private individuals or corporations own land, state law applies. And where the federal government owns land, there is this additional layer of the rural preference established in the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Schwanke.
Thank you, through the chair. If I could just add just another little tidbit, state law also does apply to a large percentage of federal land as far as hunting and fishing opportunities through preserves, refuges. So there is that a little bit additional extension as well, and it does not apply to hard park, national park lands. So I just wanted to clarify that.
Through the chair, yes, that's correct. Thank you for that clarification.
Okay, please proceed.
After the McDowell decisions, there was, of course, this new system being created kind of in an ad hoc basis to apply the rural subsistence priority. And that system, of course, resulted in its own series of lawsuits, which are known as the Katie John cases. This is a 30-year legal history that we're going to cover in one slide, so this is, of course, quite high level. This is Katie John, who was an Athabaskan elder. When the federal government first established regulations implementing the rural priority, they only applied it to land initially, to hunting. They didn't apply it to fishing right away. The first Katie John case, Katie John 1, was a lawsuit by Katie John saying that the rural subsistence priority had to apply at least in some waters because it mentions priorities for fishing and for fishing being important. And the courts agreed and said that the rural priority, based on the language of ANILCA, had to apply at least in some navigable waters. It wasn't clear which navigable waters those would be. As the regulations developed and started to implement exactly where the rural subsistence priority would apply for fishing, there were additional rounds of litigation. In 2001, the Ninth Circuit reaffirmed the original holding of Katie John 1. In 2013, the Ninth Circuit affirmed the way that the law, the secretaries decided to apply ANILCA's rural subsistence priority to fish was that it would apply on waters appurtenant to federal lands, meaning waters that ran through or adjacent to federal lands would have the same rural subsistence priority as the federal lands, and then waters running through state lands or entirely enclosed around state lands, the rural subsistence priority would not apply to those waterways. That system carried on for several years. There was another wrinkle to it in the case called Sturgeon v. Frost in 2019, where the Supreme Court clarified that just because the federal government could regulate subsistence fishing in these waterways didn't mean it could regulate everything in these waterways. That case dealt with access regulations and access restrictions by the Park Service, but the Supreme Court expressly did not overturn the subsistence regulation system established in the Katie John cases. And then just this past January, actually, we finally got to the end of a case called U.S. versus Alaska, where the Ninth Circuit again affirmed that after the Sturgeon case, the Katie John system continues to apply. So what this worked out after 30 years of litigation was that the federal subsistence priority applies on federally owned lands for hunting and on waters appurtenant to federally owned lands for fishing. Elsewhere in the state, waterways are subject to state regulation. So this slide sort of gives an overview of how all of the different federal laws that implicate subsistence, hunting, and fishing interact with each other. You, of course, have ANILCA and the Rural Subsistence Priority, but that's not the only federal law that implicates subsistence. Under the National Environmental Policy Act, NEPA, major federal actions undertaken by the federal government have to consider impacts to subsistence when they're doing environmental analyses. And then there are numerous resource-specific federal statutes, including the Marine Mammal Protection Act, the Endangered Species Act, the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, the Whaling Convention Act, and the Magnuson-Stevens Fishery Conservation and Management Act that impact subsistence or have exemptions to their generally applicable regulations for subsistence uses. The longer version of this presentation has slides for each of these statutes that we can provide if you would like. We've had to cut those slides for time today, but each of these laws has either an impact on subsistence or has special carve-outs for subsistence uses from their otherwise generally applicable regulations. And then, of course, on state and privately owned lands and waters, state law applies. As we discussed briefly, the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act established the Federal Subsistence Board, which is composed of 11 members, a chair and 5 public members, all of whom are appointed by the Secretaries of the Interior and Agriculture and who possess personal knowledge of and direct experience with subsistence uses in rural Alaska. 3 of the 5 members are selected from individuals nominated or recommended by federally recognized tribal governments, and then the other 5 members of the board are the Alaska Regional Directors or their agents of the National Park Service, Fish and Wildlife Service, Forest Service, Bureau of Land Management, and Bureau of Indian Affairs. The Federal Subsistence Board is advised by the Regional Advisory Committees, called RACs. There are 10 RACs, each of which are local to a subsistence region of Alaska. RAC members are local residents with knowledge of subsistence practices and use area. They hold at least 2 public hearings a year to gather information and to make recommendations to the FSB. The FSB is required to defer to the recommendations of the RACs unless it finds that the recommendation is not supported by substantial evidence, violates principles of fish and wildlife conservation, or would be detrimental to subsistence needs. In general, the state of Alaska has general management authority for fish and wildlife unless there is some act of Congress that diminishes or modifies that authority in a specific way. Alaska manages fish and game through the Board of Game and the Board of Fisheries, each of which are comprised of 7 members, and their purpose is to conserve and develop Alaska's wildlife and fishery resources. Like the FSB and the RACs, the Alaska Board of Game and Board of Fish are advised by 84 local advisory committees throughout the state, which provide similar local forums for fish and wildlife issues, develop and evaluate regulatory proposals, and make recommendations to the boards. In Alaska, the state definition of subsistence is the non-commercial, customary, and traditional uses of wild renewable resources by a resident of the state. As you can see, the Alaska definition applies to all residents. It does not limit subsistence to rural residents. Anyone who's been a resident of the state for 12 months can count as a resident of the state for purposes of the subsistence regulations, unless they happen to be standing in a non-subsistence area. There are parts of the state has designated as non-subsistence, where dependence on subsistence is not a principal characteristic of the economy, culture, and way of life, and those tend to be urban areas, the areas around Anchorage, Fairbanks, Juneau, Ketchikan, Valdez. The Board of Game and Board of Fish determine if subsistence harvests can occur consistent with the sustainable yield principle, and how much harvest is reasonably necessary for subsistence uses, and then implement subsistence regulations that provide reasonable opportunities for subsistence uses before providing for other uses like sport and recreational hunting and fishing. If there's not enough of a harvestable resource for all subsistence uses, the boards of fish and game will then limit subsistence users based on their direct dependence on the fish and game population and the availability of other food if subsistence uses are restricted or eliminated. So going back to that map that we saw earlier, the current state of affairs for subsistence regulation in Alaska is that the Federal Rural Subsistence Priority applies on federal lands and on appurtenant waterways, and any non-federal lands, including lands owned by Alaska Native corporations or tribes or individuals, are subject to subsistence laws, and there are subsistence implications from other federal statutes. Now I'm going to hand it back over to Joe Nelson, and Joe and Ben are going to talk about options for reforming subsistence management. Thank you for bearing with me through that very fast and high-level overview.
It's a lot of information. I believe we have a question from Representative Ruffridge, Mr. Toy.
Thank you, Chair Divert. Through the chair, so this is actually maybe a strange question, but if you are seeking a resource in a subsistence way currently, and you are in a, let's say you're living in a rural area that is currently an ANCSA-owned or privately owned property under state management, are the people in those areas seeking out federal land to subsist on because it's easier and falls under a more clearly defined, I don't know, subsistence priority? I'm trying to understand if that's kind of the state of affairs, and on the state of affairs slide.
Through the chair, thank you for that question. If I understand your question correctly, it's basically, do people who live in rural areas of the state preferentially seek out federal lands to benefit from the Rural Subsistence Priority?
You are actually capable of putting together words early in the morning. I'm not. That actually was what I was trying to ask. Thank you.
I've had a lot of coffee. Thank you. That's a very local – that'd be a very locally variable question. I expect that people go where the resource is, and then they are subject to whatever regulations apply on those lands. One of the issues that Ben and Joe are going to talk about in the options for reform slides is that a lot of rural subsistence users find these overlapping systems very cumbersome and difficult to figure out, because if you're following a herd of moose, or a herd of caribou or something, and they cross over an invisible line separating state-owned land from ANC-owned land or state-owned land from federally-owned land, suddenly different regulations apply to whether you're allowed to harvest that resource or how you can go about harvesting that resource. Mm-hmm. So I think that the way these systems overlap is an issue that burdens people looking to harvest those resources as they follow them from where they move between different land ownership structures. I don't know if in specific areas people preferentially seek out land owned by the state or land owned by the federal government to benefit from the particular regulations applicable to whichever resource they're going after.
Okay. Follow up. Thank you. And I guess thank you for bringing in the hunting application, because that is I come from a fishing community, so my brain is always thinking about fish. And I know that we have very specific spaces where we typically catch fish, and those don't really – I mean, they kind of move, but not really. And so I was asking that more in the fishing sort of frame of mind. I understand why that hunting implication would be maybe a little more challenging. But from a fishing perspective, is that also the same answer?
Through the chair, like you said, people go where the fish are. Yeah. And so if the area that people want to fish is subject to state regulation, then they're under state regulation. And if the area that want to fish is subject to federal regulation, they're under federal regulation, and that may displace people who want to be able to fish there if they don't qualify as rural residents.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, we have a couple more questions before we go on. Representative Carrick.
Thank you, through the chair. There's a lot of pieces to untangle, so I'm going to try to just maybe regurgitate a couple things and see if I'm on the right track. So the regional advisory councils are under the Subsistence Management Board, which is federally established. And the Fish and Game obviously has our Board of Fish and our Board of Game. And then you have this slide about 84 advisory committees throughout the state. So two questions. One is, where do the advisory committees fall in that management structure? The second question is, what is the relationship between the Federal Subsistence Board and the Boards of Fish and Game? If you could talk a little bit more about that.
Through the chair, thank you for the question. The 84 advisory committees advise the Boards of Fish and Game, their state level. So the federal level has the FSB and the 10 RECs. The state level has the Board of Fish, Board of Game, and these 84 advisory committees. The Federal Subsistence Board's regulations are only applicable on federal lands and waters. They don't have any applicability outside federal lands and waters. The state committees have much wider applicability on state-owned land, privately owned land. So the relationship between them is sort of based on geography.
Mm-hmm. Through the chair, kind of going back to these two questions, you know, really depends on land ownership of where you're at, and also it is kind of competition for resources, right? If you are in a community that does have road access, right, you're welcoming the ability for your state users to come in and, you know, depending on the land, you know, have a different eligibility there versus what might be federal lands right adjacent. So for a community, for a small community or a small tribe or a small community of like 100 people, it is difficult to manage just because you have to go to the FSB, have to go to the RAC for you know, to put your input onto the federal lands, federal geography. You have to go to one of the 80 or so advisory committees on the state side, as well as Board of Fish, Board of Game, to, you know, management for what is could be a use on land that's literally right adjacent to the federal land. So for our communities, you can do need to have your own lawyer to kind of go around and figure out, you know, what land you're on and also what decision body to go talk to. So.
Thank you. Yeah, just as a follow-up, is that in a community, if it's small and you're on federal and close to state and trying to get food to feed your families, does that fall in the community tribe, like a tribal government within that small community ever?
Chair, you know, our tribes do have a relationship with federal government. They do have that trust responsibility. So a tribe is a government, sovereign government. So for, like, you know, I could talk about some of our smaller communities, but the tribe would be the government in many of our communities. So, yes, it would be in that space, but also any rural resident could also be in that space as well.
Okay. Thank you. We have two more questions. We have a question from Representative Underwood and then Representative Schwanke.
Thank you, Chair Diaper. Through the chair, back on slide 19, when it's talking about the FSBs and the RACs, I'm just curious. That's like the 10 subsistence areas. How many RACs, I think you may have quoted it before, are there in the FSBs? I'm curious how many Alaska Native voices are represented in those seats. Is it a ratio of actual Alaska Natives versus just a rural resident? Like, what is the representation on those boards?
Through the chair, thank you for the question. There are 10 RACs. The only legal requirement for RAC membership is that the person be a local resident with knowledge of subsistence practices and uses in that region. I don't have the breakdown memorized, but it's certainly available. You can see the RAC membership on the FSB's website.
Follow up. Has there ever been any discussion on requiring, like, a tribal member or a certain amount of seats to be Alaska Native on those boards? Just curious.
Through the chair, not that I'm aware of.
On the FSB.
Yeah.
Thank you. Representative Schwanke.
Thank you, through the chair. I just kind of wanted to add that I was hoping that you guys could expand a little bit on the
there's an additional advisory group called the Subsistence Resource Commission. Could you describe to the committee a little bit more about what that group is and where they're situated and what they do?
Through the chair, thank you for the question. Yes, the Subsistence Resource Commissions operate to govern harvest of fish and wildlife for subsistence purposes within national parks. They're kind of a separate structure. They also advise the Federal Subsistence Board, but they have a very specific geographic scope in that they advise on subsistence uses within national parks.
Thank you.
We should add a slide on them. Thank you for that question.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Okay. Thank you very much, members of the committee.
Madam Chair, we're going to go through options to reform. Aviculture Joe Nelson is going to join me. We're going to kind of split this up. Again, as we talk about this, you know, we talk about subsistence in a very...
Name on the record.
Oh, yeah.
Joe Nelson, co-chair AFN.
Okay.
And before we jump into this, Madam Chair, can I quickly just touch on a couple of items that came up as I was sitting back here? And we're keeping our lawyer close for further follow-up.
Absolutely.
But
yes.
Through the chair, Representative Ruffridge, and all of you, thanks for engaging. This is going to help us develop this, the content, as we continue to socialize this and bring up our collective IQ on subsistence as a state. 61% of the state is federal, and 24% is state-held. The rest is privately held. The comments around traditional hunting and fishing, it's traditional and customary uses. You know, there's terms of art in each of these federal laws. And we all, every Native person is specific to a place. You know, there's 21 distinct languages. There's 229 federally recognized tribes. We're very, very diverse, but we're consistent in the fact that we're connected to the place we're from, and that includes all the wildlife, all the fish, and we have our traditional laws that are all very unique on how we manage those. So most of us don't grow up thinking about which rack we're going to go try to participate in. We learn from our grandparents, and we just work with the seasons. And in Yakutat, just a small example, because that's where my history is from, it's, I mentioned earlier, Takwadi. If anybody right now is in Lost River or Seatuck area in Yakutat, there's likely brown bears right there, and we're the brown bear clan, and that's Takwadi. But the Takwadi also have folks that originated in Ketchikan, and there's Takwadi in Angoon. So we're diverse, have a rich history. I'm a child of the Quashka Kwan. You go up to Humpy Creek in Yakutat, you know, that's where the humpback salmon show up, and every river, every stream from Dry Bay to Yakutat Bay to Icy Bay, and all the rivers in between, we utilize that whole coast of 400 miles right there for all the things. But in Southeast in particular, there's a long clan history of how we manage those resources, how we access them. So first and foremost, the whole point is customary and traditional use. ANCSA happened because we still held Aboriginal title. It did extinguish Aboriginal title for holding land, but we're still stuck with trying to figure out how to unwind the managing of all the resources on all these properties. So I just wanted to touch on that before we dive in. And the slides here, Ben is going to cover a number of them on the federal side, and then we have some for the state. But we go back to AFN. We have an annual convention every year. In 2024, the resolution 24-1, that's one that's going to stand for a while because we adopted a framework to think about subsistence, to try to get folks thinking about all the different issues, because there's not going to be a silver bullet. This is going to be a long journey that is going to require both federal and state action at the many levels to come forward with any meaningful change. So that's why we're having to take our time to work through these, and the front slides are the federal ones.
Yes, thank you for answering some of those questions. I think we have a follow-up from Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you, Chair Dipert, and thank you so much for that answer. So the phrase traditional and customary is found in the ANILCA Federal Rule of Subsistence Priority. but not found anywhere in state language currently. Is that correct?
That's why we have our attorney next to us. So that is a fundamental issue of the actual words do matter, every little word. And we're going to get into it in a little bit about the Constitution being a big issue. And the word rural is also going to be the key word. So you're probably right on that.
Okay. I mean, just a comment, if I may.
Yes, follow up.
So, I mean, I feel like I'm a subsistence user of the resource in my community. But then growing up, had a number of friends who were I would say traditional and customary users of the same resource, who are members of the Kenaitse tribe. And the way that we used the resource was dramatically different. Ultimately, we still caught the fish. How we used the fish, processed the fish, and what the fish meant to us was actually very different. And so I would be interested in sort of noticing or questioning as we go through the presentation. I feel like words are unique and need to be sort of used appropriately, but they also have to be defined. Who do you think should be responsible for defining customary or traditional? Because I feel like sometimes that gets either lost or not well stated somewhere. I mean, who should be responsible for that?
Yeah, thank you for that question. You know, and it makes me think of my own family who, you know, they don't have a word for subsistence either. They had words for food season by season. I recently asked my dad, you know, what does spring mean in Khoikhoi? And he's like, well, we call it Bekinale time. You know, it's the time where we hunt muskrats. So that's a great question. Words do matter. But then you think of the regional part, too, of each part of Alaska and those hunting and gathering traditions. But maybe you will get to it in further slides, Mr. Nelson.
Through the chair, okay. I've got a real quick nutshell answer, and then we will get to some of this. Mm-hmm. Through the chair, Representative Ruffridge, thank you. That is, in a sense, the $64,000 question, and it's dynamic in every community. But one thing that's pretty clear is that none of this would be here but for the people that were here for thousands of years and were still here. And the governing entities in each of these communities, a lot of the front lines governing body is the community, the tribe, the tribal council. So I think there's a fair observation to be made that these decisions, when we're talking about customary and traditional, you got to really lean in on that traditional knowledge. And that's why that's coming up before more of a thing to be actually, how can a scientist come in and understand anything for a little while and study a few seasons of a few cycles of fish runs? And ignore the people that have been there, literally the salmon people, for thousands of years who are on the waters right now. So I think there's a you're on point on finding these definitions, but they are going to shift a little bit as you go around each community. But I think there's a common denominator there, and that's the traditional knowledge, which is dynamic. The world does turn. Things do change. None of us really have the exact crystal ball, but we can agree on definitions. And that's the whole point of governing, is to come to a common framework here. So thank you for that.
And, Madam Chair, just to add to that.
Yes.
The state definition for subsistence does include the non-commercial, customary, and traditional use of wild renewable resources by resident of the state. So any resident of the state for direct personal or family consumption as food, shelter, fuel, clothing, tools, or transportation for the making, selling of handicraft articles out of inedible byproducts of fish and wildlife resources taken for personal or family consumption and for the customary trade, barter, or sharing for personal or family consumption. Again, this kind of falls down to geography. You know, Representative Ruffridge, you mentioned Kenaitse. They fall under a non-subsistence use area. So, you know, their history of living in that land for 10,000 plus years, they can't benefit from this definition because this is what happens where they're at geography-wise. So as we talk about subsistence, Joel mentioned it, every region is different. Every 12 region has its own connection to subsistence. Every region, every community is different. And definitions and verbiage matters. And so when we talk about this issue here, you know, subsistence, you know, both rural and what Chair Dybert has mentioned, like, you know, it means, you know, is also our ancestral connection to who we are as people. And those are two different connections that we're talking about here as well, as well as geography.
I appreciate that. Thank you, Mr. Malott.
So federal options, again, we mentioned it here a couple of times. You know, when you talk about this issue, it is a very complex web of both state and federal law. One thing that, you know, when we talk about this framework, and, you know, AFN doesn't have an exact position. There's options for extension for our community and for everyone in the state to consider. But again, every region is different. Every region has its own connection to land. Every region has its own different capacity. Every region has its own different use of subsistence, mixture of commercial, non-subsistence, and subsistence use. But one thing that stands, you know, is under AINSCA Section 4B, we actually repealed our Aboriginal title. Under the, you know, definition or understanding that the Secretary of Interior and Agriculture would provide for subsistence activities, but yet our British corporations, you know, sected lands based on Aboriginal use. And also our regional corporations sected law lands on that use as well, including historical sites. So one of the things that, you know, we talk about here as an option is, you know, as we talk about state trespass and other issues on private lands, is actually repealing this section of AINSCA to get back the Aboriginal title of Aboriginal hunting and fishing rights that, you know, we were asked to select for. So that's one option that we're looking at that, again, goes back to geography, that would impact lands owned by Alaska Native corporations and Alaska Native village corporations. Again, that is an amendment through Congress, and we have amended AINSCA many, many times. So this discussion that we're having, and I think this, you know, is a wide, broad discussion. Again, every region will view this differently, but we're starting that process right now. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Before you proceed, we want to follow up on. Yeah.
Going back to, again, geography and definitions, you know, the NOCA definitions, definitions matter. We all know that. Half my job work for Semerkowska is tracking down, make sure we use the right definition, because there's about 18 definitions for Alaska Native in federal statute. Mm-hmm. Rural priority, or rural residence, really. And for AFN, you know, we are good neighbors. We don't want to be just a native or rural. We want to be inclusive as possible. So geography matters. So, you know, if you do happen to be near a rural or urban location, you know, the definitions have to account for the customary and ancestral use of resources in the definitions. And so, you know, we look at this, you know, there could be a rural plus native. So not only including rural residents that need that resource and require it, but also, you know, for a native preference, actually acknowledging our 10,000 plus years of using the land and how we are as people. And so we look at, you know, different definitions that could count for that. And one option is, you know, a native plus reference or a definition in the NOCA. Again, that is a federal change. That'll be working through our Congress. But again, that definition too would take time, and we're working on that. And we value input from the state as we, you know, look at definitions that would impact all of our state residents.
And just, I'm going to do a quick time check. It's 9 o'clock, so we'll have about one more hour left. And just a reminder to clarify who is talking for the record.
Okay.
Yes, thank you. And Representative Ruffridge has a follow-up.
Thank you. On the repeal ANCSA extinguishment clause slide, I feel like this is a really big deal and probably would be somewhat difficult to accomplish. Is there, consensus amongst your organization that this is something that would be sought after, you know, sort of from a larger perspective, kind of combined Alaska Native Voice? Because that sort of strikes, I think, at the heart of ANCSA and really says how I read this, and I just want to preface that I might have this wrong, is, well, maybe ANCSA wasn't what we hoped it would be, and we regret that it happened. And because I feel like there was an idea here of we're going to try something new that hadn't been done before, and part of that was saying we're okay with sort of this exchange happening, right? Where we're going to be granted something that gives us, you know, something that has like a long-standing, you know, claim, like land, right? But in exchange for that, we're going to say that this title goes away, right? And to make this clause seems like it's the foundation of ANCSA, and so to repeal it or to get rid of it, I guess brings it into question in my mind. Maybe I have that wrong, and I would like to just kind of hear where you're at.
Okay. Through the chair,
yes, Mr. Nelson,
Joe Nelson, co-chair, Representative Ruffridge. Yes, this is a big deal, and the Alaska Federation of Natives is a large membership entity, and there are a whole host of things that we really don't get to consensus on, but they're like a unanimous consent. But our goal
I don't know anything about that. We're always united here.
our goal is really at this stage is to understand the issues so we get to the root of an issue here. And ANCSA, it set out to settle title one specific lane, the, you know, fee simple title being what it ended up being to hold 44 million acres was retained essentially out of this big state in native hands through the corporations. But this clause did leave open a number of things. Mm-hmm. And it's in the record very clearly that the Secretary of Interior and the governor were tasked with maintaining Aboriginal hunting and fishing rights and our customary traditional use and finding an avenue. So some years later, ANILCA was debated and ended up with the compromise that we are challenged with right now. So I think that's why there's a sliding scale of options even here, and whether or not it comes up. I mean, this is a big reason why it hasn't been the top priority, is because there's so many things that it would open up a lot there, because it's a critical part of ANCSA here. So you're right on. So our job is to more educate all the different avenues here and options, and it will be an ongoing package deal of adjusting the constitutional issue, if possible. That, you know, that's ultimately a thing that needs to probably happen, and then the federal and state laws and all the definitions coming into synchronicity and harmony, and then the regulations. So all the things need to get on the table. So this one is one that might not specifically need to get touched, but we need to be aware, because it's the heart of where the problem started, because it didn't get resolved in the beginning. It got kicked down the road.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Through Chair, Madam Bemelot, this was passed in our Resolution 2401. This was included in that framework, so we have a little bit of consensus there. And again, it goes back to geography of where you're at. It really matters in subsistence in this case, but also, you know, definitions. So you have almost a perfect public policy conundrum of definitions and personal use and geography. Also, with that said, too, you know, the state did seek out to have a system that implemented ANILCA before McDowell. So there was a process to, you know, to implement a unified solution before until McDowell. So I'll throw it out there as well.
Okay. Thank you. Please proceed.
Yep.
Looks did we cover some slides?
We think we did. I'm trying to catch up real fast. So Native Plus, we're actually going through this really at a good pace. So again, going back to definitions, you know, ANILCA matters. So look at how we could incorporate both rural, and then also how we include a native, or somehow we include our ancestral and traditional ties to the lands that we've used. Again, definitions, Alaska Native. As you all know, multiple statutes have different definitions. And, you know, also how we define descendants. This is something that, you know, we're throwing out there as just a consideration as we go through this process of amending state and federal law. Pay very close attention to the definition of Alaskan Native. It varies greatly among AINSCA, among MMPA, or not having that. So I think, you know, as we look at this this process for our community as well as, you know, for all stakeholders, definitions matter, as we all know in this room.
Sorry, just a quick question.
That's a follow-up, Representative Ruffridge.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. You said at the bottom here, through the chair, could be addressed through regulation. Regulation where and by whom?
So, through Chair Bemelot, so there's both statutes and regulatory. So, for example, the Marine Mammal Protection Act exempted Alaska Natives, but Congress didn't actually define Alaska Natives. It was through the regulatory process defined Alaska Natives through the AINSCA definition. So it's different ways of defining it that we had to be taken into consideration as we kind of go through this process of both amending both state and federal law.
Yeah, thank you. Just a follow-up, if I may.
Follow-up?
What federal agency in this case holds those regulations? I guess I'm trying to figure out who drafted those and how they came about.
Through the MMPA, Madam Chair, through the Chair, Bemelot, MMPA example, it would have been Department of Commerce, Department of Interior.
Okay. Thank you.
And, yeah.
Okay. Great question. Please proceed.
Again, you know, this is going over federal, both state and federal overlap in this regards. You know, we're looking at options of Title VIII is the rural, is really what we're talking about here in Anoka. You know, in this, we could preclude state management of federal lands, address and protect subsistence fisheries. So we're looking at how we could address all these actions in Anoka Title VIII. You know, one option that we have that, you know, Alaska Natives have tremendous capacity to manage our own lands. We have for 10,000 plus years. We have adapted, managed based on the resource, the allocation, and climate. You know, how we can increase management of our own lands. How we could increase our self-determination to support our customer traditional life, and also how we recognize that subsistence is not only rural, as we talk about that native plus rural definition. So that all falls within Title VIII of Anoka. With that said, going to Pacific.
So many questions. I'm sorry, Madam Chair. I think Representative Schwanku was first, though.
And just before we go to questions and making sure that we hit all the slides, it is 9:15 roughly, so about 45 more minutes. Okay, Representative Schwanke.
Thank you, through the chair. On this slide, I'm hoping that you can describe a little bit more about what you mean by precluding state management on federal lands. And I ask that with the preface knowing that state law pertaining to harvest of fish and wildlife on all state lands, private lands, and most federal lands is kind of a broad framework. And then the subsistence additional opportunity offered through the Federal Subsistence Board on the majority of federal lands is an additional layer that does offer additional hunting, fishing seasons, bag limits. How would you perceive the opportunity on federal public lands as far as other residents, like from other states, or I guess non-resident hunting, because right now all of that takes place under state law. So I'm just hoping you could expand on that bullet a little more.
Through the Chair Bemelot, AFN, one example of this is native allotments. Native allotments fall under state management. But those are, you know, for a native person's for ownership of land. So we talk about this, you know, native allotments are something that our community feels that should be, you know, fall within the federal management of that rural of that management. So native allotments is one that we talk about of precluding state or over federal lands.
Follow up. That was not so. I understand allotments are held in trust, my understanding, by the federal government. But that bullet says preclude state management on federal lands. And federal public lands are over 60% of the state of Alaska. So if we precluded state management, there would be no mechanism for opportunity to harvest at all on broad federal lands. And maybe that was not what you meant by that bullet, but do you understand what I'm asking? You might want to clarify that bullet.
Excuse me. Go ahead. You go ahead, or I'll give it a stab, Madam Chair. Joe Nelson, through the chair.
Yes.
the issue, the core issue, is the McDowell and the federal law and the state not being able to comply with federal law, and so I think most folks agree it's definitely not an ideal situation to have the ambiguity, and depending on the species or what land you're on. So the option here, my read, and I didn't put the suggestion, this bullet on the table here, but I think the idea is more certainty and less of a guessing game, to just be very clear, have bright lines then, and to limit the litigation that happens fairly constantly about all the different nuances, and then just be clear about, okay, it's a federal paradigm here, and then have fewer lawsuits between the state of Alaska and the federal government. So I think that's my read of the intent here, is for a pathway for clarity on just being, having more bright lines rather and less litigation is the idea. And even as a Native community, I don't have a sense that we've got full consensus on it's a choice. It isn't a binary choice between the federal and state. Some that may be the way we approach this and think about it, but I think most of us would agree it all needs to get on the table and sorted out, and subsistence wouldn't be an issue but for the local users. Mm-hmm. So I think there's that's my read of this bullet.
Quick follow-up.
Mr. Mallott, did you want to add to that?
I let Shrinky.
Okay. Follow-up?
I'm not trying to be difficult. I'm trying to understand what the word preclude is binary. And so I guess what I'm asking, so right now there is no federal management structure to offer hunting and fishing opportunity outside of the Federal Subsistence Board, which was designed very specifically to offer additional subsistence opportunity for rural residents. Are you suggesting that federal land managers should take on the entirety of fish and wildlife management and opportunity on federal lands above and beyond the Federal Subsistence Board, or that only rural Alaska residents should be able to hunt or fish on federal public lands in Alaska?
Through the chair, Joe Nelson. Excuse me. Definitely not, just in our native ways, we're not trying to preclude anybody. We're looking for clarity on a management regime, and the current system isn't working. And right now, we don't have a single solution. We're presenting on every slide a menu of different options that we really would go through a process to sort out. We don't have, if we did, we would present a bill and be very direct about it. But this whole presentation, you'll see every slide is kind of a sliding scale of options to zero in, to get all the issues on the table. And I know just in our native ways, we incorporate everybody else and take care of everybody the best we can, because we're group-oriented people. So there's definitely no goal to preclude folks. It's just being able to be clear about how we manage these things.
Thank you so much, Mr. Nelson. And I think I just want to do a time check. We're at 9:20.
Okay.
So 40 minutes. Should we?
And I just want to.
Yes,
follow up.
Mr. Mallott.
Yeah, thank you, Ben Mallott, AFN. And to follow up too, you know, as we talk about this, this is really a complex, geography matters, right? So if you're on Yukon around Rampart, you look at a map, you have Boyk lands, Doyon lands, federal lands, state lands, upriver, I think state, Ben River is federal, depending on what waters you're adjacent to, but then you have allotments all along the river. And so what we're talking about here too is, you know, precluding, you know, those allotments also fall within state management. So again, a different ability for use. Again, it's also different land management held in trust by the federal government or by that family. So what we're also looking for here is this clarity on lands that's connected to Native peoples and really that community. And so we're also, again, Joe mentioned, we're also that continuity of really, if you know, looking at know, how we could manage and kind of reduce the complexity just in that regards there as well. It is a patchwork of different hands.
Thank you.
Thank you for that follow-up. I think what... let's... Final question, and then I think what we'll do is go through the slides, and then we'll answer questions at the end so we make sure to hit every slide. Okay, Representative Ruffridge.
Yes, thank you, Chair Diver. Through the chair, I'm really interested to know what, and I understand that it would probably be very different depending on the geographical location, but on the slide where it says authorize Native management of Alaska Native-owned land, I'm trying to understand the tension points that exist now because it's outside of my realm of expertise, like a long way. What would that management look like, and how would it differ from sort of what is happening now? And where are you feeling the tension the most? Like, because it sounds like there's lawsuits. What would this management look like, and how would it relieve the tension, I guess, is my general question.
Yeah, through the chair, Ben Malott. That's a really good question. Again, geography matters, ownership matters. Each place we're at, what land you are, has different use qualifications for who could use that land. There is a lot of tension, especially among the road system, where you have both federal state lands and Native-owned lands, access to about every resident of the state. Again, you see right here, rural residents is different designated population versus the state is a subsistence use for all. So, like, you look at the Otna region or some parts of the interior, you know, that management could be, you know, how we enforce our own trespass on our lands. Because, you know, we are community-selected lands for use of descendants, shareholders, based on historical need and access and opportunity. And you know, as we also look at Alaska Native capacity, you know, in rural Alaska right now, it is our tribes, our organizations that are working in the community. So, you know, how can we incorporate and build a really robust rural economy by not actually having a management structure that actually incorporates our organizations helping manage the resource? Right now, a lot of that is for, you know, based in Juneau, Fairbanks and Anchorage, and goes out. But, you know, one option we have here is actually how, you know, how can we as Native people is build our own biologists to help manage our lands that actually live in the community.
That's a great. I have to go back to, I recently interviewed my dad, so I'm going to go back to my dad's story. And just, it makes me think about, because I asked him about how they manage it, how they managed firewood, gathering firewood and building, getting wood to build log cabins, and how they manage their forest around their community. And they had a system where they knew a time of year or what year it was. Let's say three springs ago, they would go gather wood from a certain area, they would circle around and do that over years. And, you know, so you have these traditional subsistence gatherings, and then a system is put on. Oh, you can't go there. There's laws because of this. There's laws because of that. So that does put strife on smaller communities that have had these traditions for years and years and years. So I can see, and it's tricky too. Yeah. So like, so it just made me think of that interview, and I just wanted to get that on the record. Please proceed.
So again, you know, Bemelot, NOCA has a provision, Section 809, that does that for cooperative agreements. We have more slides on this later on, so I can't go into that. That actually has, in the NOCA statute, opportunity for Native organizations to enter into cooperative agreements. And so going forward, you know, other issues to address, discrete issues. There's multiple, probably hundreds of state statutes that interact with subsistence. Remodel Protection Act, how we address for co-management, MNPA. For ANOs to, you know, actually self-regulate, our waiting commissions do self-regulate, and how we could, you know, increase our permitting for that. One thing that, you know, AFN has been very advocated for is actually having our two tribal seats on North Pacific Fish Management Council, and actually how we could actually be at the table in terms of that management structure. And actually, again, this is, you know, incorporating our own communities to help mitigate conflict. You know, if we're at the table, the entire state is represented. So, you know, it's just, for us, it's just a better governance. Going forward, appropriations, you know, there's not enough money. And so, you know, AFN, we've advocated very strongly, and we're thankful to Sam Murkowski, who's on appropriations for increasing, but it's never enough. A lot of our Alaska Native organizations and cooperative agreements and co-management organizations really sometimes don't have enough money to do their own federal take requirements and actually how they do their own management. And so we had to, do kind of scrape by for all of our IPCOM co-management organizations. So appropriations are a big part of this and funding that. Other options going here, going to section 80809, is that cooperative. Cooperative just means that we could advise, but we actually don't have a way to manage it. So right here, we're looking at how we actually create avenues to actually create more effective management, again, of how our Native peoples, our tribes actually can interact and have a seat at the table in this decision-making process of fish and wildlife around our communities. And you see, here there's been a number of sectoral orders kind of, expanding cooperative, but it's actually not true co-management. It's still a very cooperative-based relationship. Incorporating, indigenous knowledge or TEK, traditional ecological knowledge, into the system. The Board of Fish has done a really good job at this. This is on state level. The Board of Fish actually does have opportunity for TEK with Western Science at the beginning of each meeting. Chair Marit and Van Dort, other than Chair Wood, we appreciate that relationship, and we think that's a really amazing step forward for the state of Alaska. So how can we incorporate how we as Native peoples have adapted and managed for 10,000 plus years into the system? Again, going back to rural, like how does that definition work? How does it work for rural plus Native? How does it work for Kanaitse or Chikunun that are in non-subsistence use areas, but we still have that connection, that 10,000 plus years of use and of the resources around our communities? Going back to options, 809 of Anoka is a really big opportunity we see that I think this federal government does not use well enough. So looking at how we could expand Section 809 for cooperative into co-management. Look at MMPA, the Wayne Commission is a really good example of how Native communities have managed a resource and is self-regulating. And so we have the capacity to do it. We just need the resources and the legal avenues to go forward. Again, it's in jurisdiction, Title 8, NOCA to Native allotments. Again, reducing that confusion of what is actual Native lands, Indian lands, versus, what is has state management on top of it. Look at Rampart or Yaktat, there is ANC lands, state, federal, and then allotments, all running together. And so how can this make it a little more easier for communities to have that relationship with the governing body that oversees the use and allocation of the resources on those lands? Again, sectoral order declaring Title 8 of Anoka as Indian destination. This is a very nuanced congressional ask. This goes to the parliamentarians within Congress, and it's something that AFN has argued that Title 8 of Anoka is in fact in administration and should fall within the Senate Committee on Affairs versus Senate Engineering National Resources. Again, these are all options we have at the table. We're just kind of throwing it all out there, just to get people aware of what actually needs to happen and what needs all these different layers. And again, Alaska Native organizations have the ability to compact and contract with the federal government. So how can we look at opportunities where we could, contract with the federal government for management of this process and expanding that resource? Again, we've also asked for President Authorization Working Group to look at this, because again, this has Department of Commerce, Department of Interior, Department of Agriculture, all within this very one state nuance of a complex of statute federal laws, and actually how we can have this one resource group looking at this in one time. So we've also advocated for this many times. Again, in revised structure FSB, we're very happy with the three nominated Alaska tribal seats. Again, our tribes are often the governments in rural Alaska. So again, looking at how the Federal Assistance Board can actually implement the voices of rural residents, and again, the tribes being that government in many of our communities. It doesn't mean it had to be Alaska Native. It has to be nominated by a tribe. So it's not racial. It's instead to be nominated by the tribe, which is often the tribal governments within our local communities. Again, you know, we're open to ways to make this better. Again, it's really onerous for communities to have to go to 10 racks, to FSB, then they have to go to the 84 ACs on the state side and the Board of Fish, Board of Game, and they have Big Commercial Game Service Board, and you have North Pacific. And so for our communities, they're trying to navigate this patchwork of just geography, looking at how we could, you know, make the system easier and incorporate our voices. For a small town, you know, maybe a tribe has maybe 2 employees. That's a lot of work for a small tribe to be advocating for our communities in all these different realms. And then again, that's all federal. We have state resources and state legislatures. I'll hand this off to Joe for his part.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Malott.
Madam Chair, Joe Nelson. We're getting close. Sorry.
No, actually, I just got a note saying we're doing great on time. So a breath.
Got you.
Yeah, time. We have about 30 minutes left.
And we do hope for discussion. And there's each of those slides, I could have added more, but we really need to have a dialogue is the goal here. So thank you for being engaged. Those first few slides are those ones that Ben just went through. Clearly, those are federal laws. We don't have much influence in this building on those. We do have some, but you're not making those laws. This component here really is the heart of the issue. The federal law, ANCSA, and then ANILCA happened to try to fix an issue, which is more also another compromise, and then that ran smack into our state constitution, and even that had a dissenting opinion there, I believe. And the Constitution, like ANCSA, the Constitution has been amended, I think, 28 times in its history. Most recently, I think in 2004, it was amended. So not in the last 20 years, but in our recent memory, it has been amended. And there were efforts to strike the balance, but that ended up in the McDowell decision. And then a number of votes in this building happened, and it didn't quite get there. I believe it's all of you know better than I. I think it's 2/3 of the building needs to agree to get a constitutional amendment that goes to the people. And we got close on this issue a number of times through the 90s. And there are some sense that we need to do this type of education to be ready for, if we're ready as a state, to go ahead and take this to the people of Alaska. So that's the goal of the bigger effort here, is to really not really, it's just to bring us all together, to really fully flesh out the issues. And this year is the core one, is to have the folks in the building here agree on the language. I think there's a slide here that came up next, might be yes. So just recently, this did also, is why it bubbled up. HJR 22, I think a lot of you are in the building. Representative Baker at the time brought that, and there was, you know, reaction, and now we're all here. So it, in a way, it was a gift for him to show that, bring that up. It didn't come through AFN. It didn't have AFN's endorsement at the time, but we definitely was like, okay, we're ready to start having this conversation again and educating ourselves and everybody else. And just a note on that. You know, there's not a law school in Alaska, and most of our lawyers, everybody, you have to kind of learn it on the job, in it, which is what we're working on here. And I think we are really getting close to the end of the presentation, and looking forward to more dialogue here. A lot of these positions, these key positions, they're political appointments, and the governor, whoever's in the governor's seat, plays a very key role, and that's a opportunity, obviously, is to just have a good, clear communication and commitments from the governor and then the state on working with the tribes. I think the fact that you're in the building as a normal thing at 8 a.m. on Thursday is powerful. You know, this hasn't been here too long, tribal affairs. That's a statement. And so we do feel like this is becoming more of a time to do our job and show up in the building as much as we can. So thank you for that. And yes, we're here to have a little back and forth on the presentation.
Okay. All right. We have, it's 9:35, so we're doing actually excellent. We hit all the slides. We did our goal. Thank you both so much. And I'm sure we have a few questions. That was a lot of slides to go through quickly on federal issues, state issues. Any thoughts or Representative Schwanke?
Thank you, through the chair. Thank you, gentlemen. My background, I'm well aware this is a very complex issue, so you guys did very good trying to boil it down, and we got done in an hour and a half there. So that was fantastic, so kudos on that. I have a specific question pertaining to some federal actions that I want your input on, but I wanted to initially kind of mention something that occurred in my region that I think is important to point out to folks. So we have several advisory committees that advise the Board of Game and Board of Fish. And within Copper Basin, there was a request a number of years ago, I want to say it was about 15 years ago, by OTNA to set up a separate adjacent advisory committee to the Copper Basin. And it wasn't something that the state could do. So what they did was added several seats. I think they added somewhere between 6 and 8 seats to the actual Copper Basin AC. And so right now there are actually 20 seats on that AC, 15 designated, 5 alternates. Unfortunately, 8 of them are vacant right now, and it includes several of our villages. And so people could be participating in that process but aren't, because we know there's only so many hours in the day and we're all volunteering for so many things. So I know there is that opportunity. But one of the things that our Copper Basin AC did in collaboration with OTNA a number of years ago is they helped set up under the state system what was called the Community Harvest Subsistence Program. And the first one was implemented in the OTNA region, and it was initially called the OTNA Subsistence Harvest Hunt. And it went through some lawsuits, understandably, because the original proposal as passed was just in application to the 8 OTNA villages, and that was found unconstitutional. So what ended up happening was that that hunt in particular was broadened a little bit, so everybody could participate in group applications. However, all of the harvest requirements were OTNA traditional harvest requirements. So you had to harvest the hide, the heart, the head, the liver, the kidneys, and there was some discussion about the stomach. And then they decided, maybe they would back off a little bit. But it was a really good kind of collaborative opportunity for everybody to participate. And so it is a community harvest structure where permits, it's kind of the first in the state where people can join the group, and then the permits can get moved around depending on who has the ability to harvest. So that's a program that is operating kind of under the subsistence framework. And you didn't go into it very deeply, but the state subsistence framework operates in a way that if there's not enough opportunity for everybody, then it falls into a tier one category, which is all Alaska residents. And this community subsistence harvest hunt is actually in that tier one category. At such time, a resource falls below what that type of opportunity can sustain, then it falls into a tier two category. And it's important to note that the state does have a pretty robust tier two application process, which does ask the questions about your history of use, your dependency, and the resource. So I think that's a really important realization, that the state subsistence opportunity is fairly robust, and it does capture a lot of historical use and dependency. That said, I wanted to get your take on something that has happened over the last 3 federal administrations, and it's unfortunately been kind of a football, and that is some of the customary and traditional take of predators on federal land. And it kind of, if you go back to kind of 2015, 2016, the Park Service started it, and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service kind of followed suit, and what they did was they said that traditional ways of taking predators, which were Alaska Native traditions, that included take of bears in the den, those practices were not in alignment with overarching federal, at least park policies. And then, like I said, Fish and Wildlife Service adopted it. So that federal administration said no to all of that. And a lot of people in Alaska Native groups and other hunting conservation groups actually came together and fought that. And then under the first Trump administration, they got exceptions and they allowed that. And I know that that was really a big win for a lot of people in my district, in the Koyukuk area, really traditional practices of being able to harvest predators. And then it went back under the Biden administration. They stopped all of it again, and now it's been allowed again. So I'm curious what your take is on that, and how do we figure out in Alaska with, I think we have 5 different federal land managers, and they all have their own, you know, guiding documents and principles, but how do we as a state kind of help advocate for those traditional uses and ability to take predators in places where it is really a critical need?
Through the chair, yes. Joe Nelson, Representative Schwanke, thank you. That's a beautiful example of our goal here. There's the complexity in the sense that even as Native folks, there's not a single solution, but the solution that's singular is working closely, collaboratively, to wrestle with the issues and work together. And in that example, that's part of the challenge as a Native community is these are big things, and you don't want to open the package unless you know what's in it necessarily. And here's what we're going to, you know, open something up and be ready to work together and wrestle with whatever's going to come out of it to get to a better solution. And part of that is why it's so critical that traditional knowledge is just right there on the table. Because it's not an us or them, and as the Native folks can generally agree, we cover the full spectrum, and we're frustrated with mid-administrations very often. It doesn't matter what party the administration is. We're frustrated in a big way. We're the common sense folks in the middle, and we're just trying to broaden the middle to have the safe conversations to get traditional knowledge on the table. Small example being the brown bear that I keep mentioning is, in some respects, we were like we'd honor the brown bear. But in other ways, as you know, just being, you know, familiar with our ways, we honor everything. And that does include working together and managing. It's a gift. It's an offering. My dad was a commercial guide in the 60s for bear hunting. Grew up in my household with glacier bears mounted in my house. So these things get tough because they get very personal, not just to Native people and our identity, but it's tied to families and how you make a living and why everybody's here. We're all here for the same reason, and that's to be integrated and working together in the state to continue on a way of life that we all value very much. So I think you gave a beautiful example of a component that's working, which makes it hard for us to address these issues because people worry about, the system that we fixed right here, we got a solution, we took a lot of time and effort there, but now we're going to unwind it all. It is the concern. So I don't have a great answer other than there's got to be a lot more of these and normalizing that and having fewer boards to go to, fewer things to go to. And if we just formalize a pathway to empower like we have here again, the tribal affairs, we're able to normalize these conversations at a much better level. And through this effort, I'll acknowledge Sitka Conservation, that they've got folks there that are working on a curriculum that is for everybody. On how to show up and be engaged in this, all the RACs and advisory committees and all that. There's curriculum now that's being circulated to help every Alaskan to be more familiar and more effective in advocating for these kind of solutions that you outline there.
Yes, Mr. Malott.
Mr. Malott with AFN. I just want to add to AFN co-chair Joe Dawson's talking points. You represent a really amazing point of just for our communities and opportunities to manage. Otna is a really good partner, right? Otna selected lands for their communities. The community hunt program, you know, was originally for those 8 communities, but then the state law, it got expanded to others. And so there's a population dynamic there that kind of, you know, that we had to deal with. But also you recognize too that, you know, it's not a perfect system. And we are, and as Joe mentioned, we're stuck in the middle. And so I just want to put out there, you know, what if we didn't have to be stuck in the middle? What if we had one system that, you know, incorporated that our communities could go to, like one system where Aetna is actually the table in this management structure, actually at the table. One system where, you know, we don't have to go board of fish, board of game, just go to one board. And so, you know, I can't talk about this. These solutions can go towards that. But, you know, with their example, it's a really good example of just what our communities have to do to try to navigate the system. And I say navigate, not succeed, just navigate the system. Mm-hmm. And so what we're doing here is, you know, we know that each system is not perfect. We're tired of being stuck in the middle. And that's where we're at right now. So good to sheesh.
Mm-hmm. Quick follow-up. Anabasi, for your words. Follow-up.
Just super quick. I thank you for that. I, as a rural subsistence, I'm a federally qualified user. I hunt, I fish, I trap with my family, and I teach kids as much as I can. And so I appreciate that. And I would love nothing more than there just to be one system as well. And of course, I think everyone on the committee here and understands that it really comes down to whether or not the state legislature is willing to move in that rural priority direction. But I'll just leave you with a quick, one of my favorite books I read many, many years ago is called Playing God in Yellowstone by Alston Chase. I highly recommend it. It's a very interesting initial look at humans' attempts to put boundaries on wildlife populations, and they found out that that didn't work very well. So thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you for that. We have a question from Representative Carrick.
Thank you so much for presenting today, and I think there's so much information that we just need three or four more presentations on to kind of wrap around. I wanted to go back, if possible, to the slide early in the presentation about resource harvest by use in Alaska, and it was that pie chart of commercial fishing and then pulled out the smaller pie chart.
We did really good.
There it was. And I guess we have just near collapse of traditional and subsistence use of fisheries on the Yukon and Kuskokwim drainages today. And I'm wondering, I know there are many factors, climate related, just many factors that lead to that collapse. But I'm wondering if there's a comment you could provide on what, if anything, in our management structure leads to this tiny portion of the pie facing such huge implications for life, livelihood, et cetera, because our communities are suffering today. And I see this chart, and it's only this very small percentage that's subsistence, 0.9% subsistence hunting and fishing, and even smaller portions for personal use and sport fishing. And I just wonder if there's something in our management as a federal or state level that we could have or should be doing differently to prevent or reverse this trajectory.
Thank you, Mr. Millat.
Thank you, Ben Millat with AFN. That's a really big question. I think it all goes back to governance. You know, as, you know, Representative Schwanke mentioned, you know, fish and moose, caribou, they don't care whose land they are, right? You can't really contain them on land. We know that. We've known that for 10,000 plus years. You know, look at the management structure, Board of Fish, Board of Game, and the Fair Assistance Board. Fair Assistance Board actually doesn't really have any commercial seats on there. You know, it's managed by rural residents and then the landowners. So I think it goes down to who's at the table in all of this. For Alaska Natives organizations, Alaska Native corporations, you know, we selected lands based on historical need. And we are in the communities, the tribes are in the communities, they are the governments. And so, you know, I think when you incorporate local government best you can, you'll find a better solution of resource management. I'll leave it there. Maybe Joel could add more to what I said, but that's a really awesome question, and mm-hmm. It makes me think more, so. Mm-hmm.
Madam Chair,
Mr. Nelson,
through the Chair, Representative Carrick, thank you for putting that on the table. That in many ways is like such a tragedy and so emotional to these communities, because most of us do consider ourselves fish people, largely because of the salmon run, and this here is really a good spot to get to in this presentation and bring it back to, because that's the sense of urgency for all of us. So I think the primary thing here is to agree that the local voices really need to be not just voices, they need to be in the decision-making seats governing these things. So there's more direct lines of accountability and less of a buffer from political appointees and other things that are, you know, politicizing things to actually have a lot more direct accountability to the folks that are making decisions. And a lot of these do get into more of the federal side, because obviously our salmon all get out into federal waters. There's the North Pacific Management Council, which just had a big, you know, week of meetings. They hear a lot and get a lot of testimony. There's big industry involved, obviously. So that's going to bring out the big guns. But at the end of the day, what is bigger than, you know, the work that Tribal Affairs right here is doing, if the First People, which are a significant part of the population, are not able to raise their children similar as their grandparents were raised on those same villages, finding ways to care for the lands. And there's new models. Right now, down at Klinkin Haida, at the Elizabeth Pratchovich Building, the Indigenous Guardians are meeting, I think, all week. And this is around the globe. It's not just a novel thing from here. It's more of a best practice that is taking hold, you know, in Australia and Canada and parts of our communities where the Native folks are actually networking together to bring our own information to the table and learn how to really integrate it better with our gadgets and ideally socialize that up to the governing system so we actually have true representation using real-time data with the real users that are there. So I think at the end of the day, it's a good governance question that all of, you know, 26, we as AFN should be asking that question to everybody who's going to, you know, run and then our next governor to really help us work through these sticky issues. They're, you know, we need to run towards these issues. So thank you.
Thank you. Yep. Follow up.
Thank you so much for that answer. I think it is complicated. And so I don't really expect, you know, a neat answer of exactly what has to happen. And I fully recognize that commercial fishing in so many of our communities is life and livelihood for folks as well. It just, I was wondering if you had a comment as well on this idea of co-management that got brought up a lot, as opposed to cooperative co-management of resource. And again, just knowing the commercial fishing industry and the Alaskans involved in it and the life and livelihood presented there, what recommendations would you have for better facilitating co-management of resource between the commercial industry and this whole little slice of the pie that represents all these various interests? And I just want to recognize that the life and livelihood of so many people is also totally dependent on this teeny portion of the pie. And I think that was something Representative Ruffridge was getting at earlier a bit too, but subsistence and personal and sports use are all in this tiny little portion of the pie. And so I guess, like, really specifically, what is it that can help facilitate better co-management of resource between Alaskans?
Through the chair, Joe Nelson, Representative Carrick, thank you. As AFN, Alaska Federation of Natives, I believe it's fair to say that our position is the solution really is for our membership to be fully engaged, fully empowered, and that includes being the advocates ourselves on these organizations with industry and nonprofits that are concerned about the health and managing the same resources that we're talking about. Right now this week, I believe, you know, United Fishermen are in town. It's Fish Week. I grew up commercial fishing, that whole coast of Yakutat. You know, this summer I'll work on, you know, getting back to it probably and be there. But we need more of our own. So it's relationships at the governance level of these things. It's having just really sharing food. That's what we do. And going directly to, you know, a cup of coffee with the folks on the other side to get to a point where we're not actually on opposite sides, where we're on the side together of agreeing that we've got a resource that we need to manage better. And we can't spend times organizing and strategizing how to win against somebody else who's another Alaskan. We have to find an Alaskan solution with all of us literally at the table. And I think that really is just a lot of work that we put on the elected officials, the presidents and executive directors of all the entities that are in here lobbying you right now, and have more heart-to-hearts and as a Native community to invite them in and feed them. That's what we do. So that's what we try to do, is to invite more folks to actually spend time with us up there and really understand where Katie John happened and what that it's all about. That should be built into our curriculum in our schools. These are things that really are foundational to who we are, that we can find mechanisms through kind of an all-in effort. You know, I think most would agree here that our children need to be a little more aware of what we're handing off to them. So I think there's many avenues to tackle this.
Yeah,
Chair, I'm not follow up. I'm not AFN, but Chairman Nelson said we recognize that subsistence. You also need to afford subsistence. You've got 100 fish. Our communities, like for example, Yaktat, where my dad's from, Jones's dad's from, it is a commercial fishing town, but we also subsistence fish. And so, if you incorporate the tribe, local ANC into the management, you're actually including a better governance structure by including those that actually use resources. Both those citizens actually commercial fish and subsistence hunt. Now, I don't want to put this on record, but I remember, you know, our tribal chairman talking about how they, you know, allow catch release of steelhead, but then steelhead eat all the king salmon fry, and we have less king salmon now. But we all known that. So, like, how can we incorporate those voices into the management, and really go back to true management of how we could both manage commercial and subsistence, but we also need economic viabilities in Alaska, and right now that is in jeopardy. So,
Thank you for sharing that, Representative Story.
Thank you, Chair Dybert, through the chair. Thank you very much for this well-ordered presentation today. I find it very helpful. A couple of things. One, I would really like the specific federal statutes on the Mammal Marine Protection Act and all those acts there. I would find that helpful. The other thing is, I know there's small steps to every process to get to where we want to go. And like I think of the federal statutes, you know, the recommendation to amend the Magnuson-Stevens Act to include Alaska Native seats to the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council. I think there's smaller, but can be a huge gain, you know, that. So it's just nice to have a document that lists all these options and steps for progress. But I also try and think so much about what we can do with the current structures, and that is as sovereign-to-sovereign governments. We have a lot of places in our statute where we say we're supposed to get tribal consultation on issues, and it seems like there's not follow-through on that on our part. And I think it's important that we, you know, ask for that. We've had a certain things in the Upper Lynn Advisory, the Upper Lynn Canal Advisory Council, where which is made up of a lot of local user groups and Alaska Native voices, where it hasn't gone through proper consultation, and they're asking for that to be done. And so I think there's things that we, as just can ask good questions about, and that government-to-government tribal consultation, you know, is a given. But I think we should put it on the table that oftentimes that is not followed through with when it really helps us get all the voices and the traditional knowledge at the table and perspective. So, again, Gunas Cheesh for your presentation today.
Anabasi. and I have just a time check. It's 9:59. We have one question from Representative Ruffridge, and then if it's okay, if we could do final wrap-up comments, if there are any. Representative Ruffridge.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Dibert. I'm pretty sure my question's not going to fit inside of a minute, but I'll ask it anyway. We can do it offline.
If you don't mind staying late for a few minutes.
Yeah, the I feel like thank Representative Carrick for bringing us back to this slide, because it was actually kind of where my question was headed anyway. You talked a lot about, this being an issue that, you have a lot of history with dealing with. And I think we've found, in my experience, that there has to be a lot of uniting around this issue, and I appreciate your comments around that as well. This is not just a first Alaskans issue. This seems to be an all Alaskans issue of how we approach this thing. This is part of the reason why I got into government work to begin with, because this is a mess. I mean, there's too much government. It's hard to – I mean, we have to have a special person here just to, like, bring us through the nonsense that we have to wade through just to have access to a resource. So my question really is, if we all could, as Alaskans here, snap our fingers and do something tomorrow, in your opinion, what does that look like? I mean, you gave us a whole series of options, but to me, that's probably the right way to do it, work backwards and kind of get to – but I always like to maybe start from the opposite end of that and say, if we could create it all new and fresh right now, what would it look like? And you don't have to answer that right now, but I would be interested to know if you had an answer to it.
Through the chair,
Mr. Nelson.
Joe Nelson. About a year ago, the federal administration was new, and a lot of things were going on, and we have an Alaska Day that we do in Washington, D.C. every year. We had a debate at the AFN board level whether or not to go over or not. We didn't hold our full board meeting over there, but we ended up having a few of us go over and spend a good, healthy week in Washington, D.C. And real quick answer, which I do think is part of the solution, we've got the 229 federally recognized tribes, and they're the original Doge. They really are. Growing up on that coast of Alaska, where some call it, they have different names for that coast. I don't know if you've covered that coast, from Dry Bay, Yakutat Bay, to Icy Bay. It's on open water, and we don't have room when you're out there doing the life of commercial fishing or subsistence. You don't have the luxury of having waste and taking too many risks. So we're very thoughtful. We're very efficient, and our tribes have been here for a long time. So in my view, finding a way to help the sovereign tribes get a little more dozy with you to find some efficiencies, and that goes back down to the Indigenous Guardians, where we are actually trying to mobilize our own folks to be on the land and water all the time, and just be there, because that's how we live. So I think there is a pathway through the tribes to do what we're doing here and what you're doing on this committee.
And Madam Chair, if you
follow
may.
Follow up?
That's not a follow up. I'm just wondering if we could name it Indogenous. That group. Just a thought, for the record.
Definitions. I think we have a new word here. Representative Schwanke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's actually pretty funny.
That's good.
This slide really just kind of represents the fact that, there are a lot of interests, obviously a lot of stakeholders and a lot of different opinions on these issues and how we manage our resources. But I just want to be kind of blunt. I'm really hoping to see your support on my fisheries resident bill, HB 297, because what I have found it's very unfortunate when we do have declining resources, and it just creates a lot more competition and a lot more frustration over the allocation. But in my mind, how I was raised, I fully respect all stakeholders interested in using our natural resources, including commercial interests. However, when we have very limited resources, I believe that our resources need to go to the people who utilize them for personal and family consumption first, and that is what HB 297 is about. So I look forward to talking with you guys further about that. Thank you.
Thank you. So I think It is 10:04, so thank you all for staying over a few minutes. This was a great topic, lots to think about when we think about our food here in Alaska, our subsistence, our lands and waters. I think one thing is clear is that we care about our resources. We care about putting food in our freezers, food for us, food for our children, grandchildren, you know, how we could manage that and how we could come together, these different governments. This is a start, I believe. And I think that you'll have a lunch and learn later on today. I can't remember which room, but look for that on BASIS. And if you have further questions, that's a good way to talk to these gentlemen. Or if you have questions for my office on this topic, please reach out to me or Almaria, Alcantara at akledge.gov, and we'll try to help you. Okay. Stand topic. Okay. That completes the agenda for our meeting today. Again, a big thank you to our presenters. Anna Bossi, so much. Thank you. My office will be in touch with all of you on our schedule for next week in tribal affairs. The time is 10:05 a.m., and this hearing is now adjourned.